It's very useful, but it's pretty unreliable too, because people's memories are not always terribly good. They do tend to exaggerate situations a bit. And it's not absolutely reliable. And history up till then had been based on written sources. But if you've got oral reports as well, they add another dimension, and they also add a warmth about a situation.
Welcome to Herstory, an RTRFM podcast series exploring the lives, careers and victories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll be with you each week as we hear stories from some of the most interesting women across the state. This week, we're going back in time, quite literally. We're about to hear from one of Western Australia's first state archivists. You know, the people tasked with keeping records of all the things associated with the state. Enter Margaret Medcalf, OAM. From growing up in Albany, working abroad, and eventually taking up a librarianship, Margaret eventually rose to become the principal librarian at the State Library during the golden era of library. From here, she also assumed the position of state archivist and introduced the Oral Histories Project. In this episode, we travel to Margaret's home in Claremont. I'm expecting her rooms to be filled with documents, books and artefacts because, well, she was the state archivist, but it's as neat as a pin. Everything has a place, and there can only be what I can describe as a few books and pieces of arts scattered across her living room tastefully. It's episode 11 of Herstory with 2014 inductee Margaret Medcalf. This is Her Story.
I grew up in Albany, yes. I was born there in 1926, and I had a lovely childhood. It was a happy home, a lovely place to be, with lots of beaches, and we went swimming a lot. We had a tennis court at home and played a lot of tennis. We lived on the side of Mount Melville, and across the road was the virgin bush of the rest of the mount. My friend who lived next door and I used to roam around on that hillside and have lovely times. We knew all the wildflowers and the animals and what rocks were the best ones to slide down. And we had very happy times up there.
It's lovely. Have you been back to Albany in recent years?
Oh, yes. In recent years, we've had a cottage down there on Oyster Harbour and have gone down there a lot.
Gorgeous.
But that's been sold now, so I haven't been down there for a couple of years.
Do you have siblings, Margaret? Or did you have siblings growing up?
Yes. I had a brother and a sister. They were a lot older than I was. My brother was 8 years older and my sister was 6 years older. So I really had the run of the home because they both went to boarding school. And so I think I was probably a pretty spoiled child.
You're the baby of the family.
Yes.
Tell us about your parents, Margaret. Your father was a notable war veteran, wasn't he?
Yes, he was engaged to my mother before he went to the war. He went in the first fleet from here in 1914. He had a pretty horrible war, but it didn't last for long. He came back in 1917. He was at Gallipoli and he was wounded there, but it was not a bad wound. He recalled that he was in the trenches there fighting at the very beginning, and they were there shooting each other day and night right through, and he dozed off a couple of times and the chap next door to him and give him a shove and wake him up to start shooting again. Then he got wounded. He must have lifted his shoulder a bit above the trench and he got wounded in the shoulder. So he had that dress. He decided, or he was told, to go back down to the beach. So he started off down that cliff and he came to a little tree. It was in the night time and he thought he'd sit down and have a little rest. So the next thing he knew, the sun was high in the sky and he'd had a good sleep. Anyway, after Gallipoli, he went to France with the troops. He was in the Battle of Pozieres, where he was badly wounded and sent back to England, and he recuperated there. And then he was repatriated back to Australia in 1917. He arrived back in early 17, and he and my mother were married in April. My brother Ian was born the next year, but I didn't come till 26.
At school, you studied chemistry and physics. I can't imagine there were too many women that were studying that at the time.
No, I didn't do that until much later in my schooling. I went through the Albany Primary School. Then, when I was about 11, there was a private school starting up in Albany called Park School, and my mother thought it would be a good idea to send me there. Or rather, she wanted to send me to Cabelia and Katanning, which is where my sister had gone. And I, for some reason, was dead against that. So anyway, I ended up in this new school in Albany, but it was not very financially viable and moved to Perth the next year. So that was in Claremont in Goldsmith Road. It was very small, with very few students. There was quite a big kindergarten, but very few senior students. I don't think we had any science. We had maths, and I think we had biology, but we didn't have anything like physics and chemistry.
So after you finished high school, you went to study at University of Western Australia, is that correct?
Yes. My unfortunate time studying science, which you asked, was in 1942 when Singapore fell. We were all evacuated home, and I went to the Albany High School, and I was doing physics and chemistry in all three junior years, and that was all little boys, and I was a bit older and a bit snooty, and that was murder.
Where were all the other women? Why weren't they doing that?
Well, there weren't any other women who took science subjects there.
Was that the norm? Not many women wanted to study, or they weren't allowed to?
No, I think they just didn't.
Why did you want to do it then?
Well, I had this idea that I was going to do medicine. So then when I came back to Perth, I went to Perth Technical College, which quite a lot of private school students, both boys and girls, went to because they didn't have any or decent teachers in science. So there was quite a big group of us who were doing physics and chem, and so that was fine. And then I went to UWA. Medicine wasn't taught at UWA at that time. But first year you could do, which was pure science. So I did 1 year, and then I went to Melbourne University.
And you came home because you were a bit homesick, weren't you?
Well, I had a lovely year in Melbourne. I enjoyed that. But I think I had too lovely a year because I failed in various subjects.
Oh, no.
And I was given subs, but it was still wartime, and there were quotas on how many students passed each year. I was in that quota, but the subs would have been in January, and that's when I felt that I would like to come home and spend the summer.
But we're glad that you did, because you came back and then you lived in the Women's College at the University of Western Australia. Tell us a bit about your time at UWA. What was that experience like?
Well, that was 46, I suppose, and all the troops had come back from the war. There was a big rehabilitation scheme which paid for the ex-army forces people to go to university. So there was a very big rehab contingent at UWA. And the Women's College was just beginning. That was its first year. So that was all very interesting and very exciting. It was an interesting time because the college was starting up with both men and women. The men's college was on the Stirling Highway side. The women's college was at the back and much smaller. It was all new. Well, it wasn't new. It was had been US military's bachelor officers' quarters.
Oh, wow.
And it was taken over by the university after the war and turned into this college. So it was pretty primitive housing. My room was painted bright blue, and they said it was high to hide all the things were written on the walls.
So you ended up then finishing with a Bachelor of Arts, didn't
then
you?
Then I turned to art subjects, yes.
Yeah, so you ended up graduating, you had a Bachelor of Arts and you had a Diploma in Education. Were you going to be a teacher?
Well, that was about all you could. They said you could be a taxi driver or a school teacher.
Okay.
With a BA. So I did the dip ed. But I wasn't any good at all as a school teacher. I was terrified of the kids. And they all thought I was a great joke, I think, coming into the class one day. And they were all pretending they were me, waving my arms around. Must demonstrate with my hands all the time.
Are you sure you're not Italian, Margaret? I can say that I'm Italian, because we talk with our hands a lot. So teaching didn't last too long for you then?
So, well, I had to do a certain amount of prac, and that's where I decided, no, I wasn't any good at that.
You finished university, and in 1961 you travelled to Britain and Europe to study archive management. What led you to that?
That's 61. We're jumping on a bit. I went in 1950 first.
Okay, what? Tell me about the time in 1950.
Well, 1950, my sister had married a Dutch naval officer and she'd gone to live in Holland. My mother and I went over to see her. Her husband was stationed in England with the Royal Navy at that time. So we had a bit of time there, then we travelled round a bit, and then I stayed on for another year and got a job in the Australian Embassy in The Hague. That was a great fun year.
Did you say at The Hague?
Mm. I was in a section called the Archives, which meant that I looked after the records. And I also had to code and decode cables that were being sent back to Canberra, to the Foreign Office. And that was interesting because it was at the time that Indonesia was leaving the Mother Holland.
Because it was a Dutch colony, wasn't it?
Mm.
Yeah.
The ambassador would go out to a function somewhere and then he'd pick up what information he thought might be interesting to Australia, come back and write a message, and I would have to code it. The embassy car would be waiting and take me round to the post office where I would deliver it to the post office. You can hardly believe this.
That's a big job, yeah.
And they would send it to Canberra.
Wow. And so was that the first time that you started to really work in archives and looking at sort of the history and relationships?
Yes, I didn't really know the word before that. And also, Canberra used to send bags of library books out to their various embassies. And they were just sitting in bags in a room. Nobody had done anything with them. So I got to and sorted them all out and put them on shelves. How I sorted them, I have no idea now. But that was the sort of beginning of any library thing too.
Right. So you went to visit your sister because she'd just been married, but you ended up staying and doing some work. How long were you over in Holland for?
Well, I was there for nearly 2 years.
And so tell us about what happened when you came back to Australia.
Well, when I came back to Australia, I didn't know what I wanted to do. There wasn't much opening for arts graduates. I went and did shorthand and typing, and then I got a job as secretary to two eye doctors.
It's another sidestep for you.
Which was really rather ridiculous. I met Molly Lucas, and she was then the archivist at the State Old Public Library. She asked me if I'd like to go and have a look at the archives that she was responsible for at the library, which I did, and I was fascinated, and that was marvellous.
What kind of things were in the archive?
Dr. Batty, who had come from Melbourne as the librarian at the public library, had been gathering together Western Australian materials. He used them to do his doctoral thesis and published A History of Western Australia. But anyway, he had got the government to transfer to the library the original Colonial Secretary's Office records, which started from the beginning of the colony on the Parmelia when Stirling and the officials were coming out. And they went through to about the 1870s, I think, the original ones that he got. And he also had got the original Lands Department records.
So before Landgate would have been a thing.
Oh, much before, yeah. Yes. And so they were in the library, and he'd also been collecting published material. There had been, actually, from 1896, a Legal Deposit Act, and so anything published in Western Australia from that period had been deposited. But he'd also been collecting private publications.
Sure.
And private documentary material, diaries and reminiscences. So there was quite a very good nucleus of stuff.
So your friend Molly shows you this because that's where she's working, and then what do you do after that? Is that something
well,
that marked you to move?
Then Dr. Batty died, and there was a reorganisation of the library, and they took in a bit more staff, and so they advertised for two appointments to the archive section. Two of us applied, and we were appointed.
Okay, so
that
what were you?
That was 1955.
That's 1955. And you've already had all this experience.
Yes, yes.
So you were the perfect appointment. You were right for the job. Mm-hmm. So what did your job look like day to day when you first arrived at the State Library?
The archive section was in an area which had been the old tea room for the staff. Colonial Secretary's Office records had been bound by Dr. Batty. There was a boundary in the library, and they'd been bound into volumes, so they were all around the walls. Molly had been indexing the Lands Department records laboriously, but she'd only got a couple of years done. There were people who came in to the general public to have a look at some of the records that were there. Aileen, being the other person who was appointed at that time, would be looking after the people who came in to ask questions, but we were absolutely terrified because we didn't know where to find anything or what to do. Anyway, we didn't do much of that answering inquiries. We were mainly looking after material as it came into the library, and there were a lot of government departmental records coming over then. There was a directive from the Premier that no government department was permitted to destroy any records without permission of the archivist. When a government department was running out of space, they had to contact Molly, and she would go and laboriously look through all the things for destruction and make decisions on what was valuable to save and what could be destroyed.
How do you even make that decision about what you can and can't destroy?
Well, there are basic rules, well, directions, I suppose, that anything that might be of administrative value to the department or historical interest should be saved. But repetitive sort of things, and obviously things that had no historical or administrative value, could be got rid of.
Did you always have an interest in history, Margaret, or is that something that developed?
I didn't have an interest in history long that line.
When did that become something that you became really fascinated with?
I think that history, as taught to us in schools at that time, was about kings and queens of England, and it was boring. And I think the way it was taught was boring. If you get a teacher who gets your interest, that's fine, but I didn't ever get caught by history.
So then when you came to the archive, things must have changed for you then.
Yes, well, it was narrowed down into Western Australian history, of course. That appeared a different sphere altogether.
Is there a particular period in Australian or in West Australian history that's your favourite?
Well, I think the beginnings of the colony probably were the most interesting to me.
If you were to take people on a tour of the archives, if you were to pick out one or two of your favourite pieces, what would they be?
I think they'd be the original instructions that were given as to how the colony would be run. The original public service directions were issued on the ship coming out, actually, and what the colonial secretary's duties were going to be, and the lands department, etc.
Why do you think it's important that we continue to remember the history, but also to keep preserving it in the archive? Why is that important?
Well, I think unless we know the background, where we came from, the future is not going to be woven into the whole pattern.
Yeah.
I think it's good to know, for everyone to know, where they came from, what's happened before.
This is episode 11 of RTRFM's Herstory. I'm Taylor Strano, and this week we're joined by Margaret Medcalf, a 2014 inductee to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame.
Let's fast forward a little bit. In 1971, you became the second ever state archivist for the WA Library, the Batty Library. It's pretty significant because Molly was the state archivist before you, and then it was you. That's two women who did that job first and foremost. That's got to be pretty huge back in the 1960s and 70s.
Well, there were a lot of women in librarianship, but there weren't any other state archivists. I remember going to a conference once, and the wife of one of the, I think, the Victorian state archivists said to me, "Oh, goodness me, a lady archivist. That's very peculiar." So I think it perhaps was. Well, it was unusual.
It's not that peculiar, though. I mean, it's just a job, right?
Absolutely.
Tell us, what was happening around the time when you took over the role as the state archivist? Did Molly retire? Did you apply for this job? How did it happen?
Yes, Molly retired. I don't know whether there were any other applicants, but I got the job. So I'd been there then for, 6 years.
You knew the lay of the land. Nobody else was going to do all that indexing either, I think. It had to be you, didn't it?
I think it had to be.
Well, they made the right choice. Alongside being the state archivist, you also became the principal librarian. What does that mean?
Because in the beginning, there were all these different sorts of records in the collection. Molly had come to the realisation that the different materials should be treated in different ways. And so the government records were treated as the archives, and the published material was treated as library material, and the manuscript diaries and those sorts of things were treated as private records. And so the state archivist was then responsible for the government records, official records, and the published material and the manuscript material became the library material.
When you took over as the state archivist and the primary librarian, what did your job look like then?
Well, what we were trying to do was collect as much private material, diaries, and those sorts of things that existed, and get them while they were still around.
Yeah.
And for people, they were discarding things. And we would work on them and organise them later on. So the prime move was collecting.
Were there many prominent people who donated or who gave their records to the library or to the state archive?
There were not very many prominent people. Well, my attitude was to get the earliest material that we could and to get that probably first.
And you have some of that dating back, like you said, to the very start of the colonisation in WA, don't you?
That is not private records, that's the official
records.
The
public, the official ones.
I can't think of any records that are, any private records that are from the original settlement.
How do you feel about the archives now, Margaret? I mean, I'm not sure the last time that you went for a visit, but I imagine a lot of it is being digitised now.
Yes, I think it's very good to get them so that they're more readily available, and also they can be sent out to other libraries and people can look at them there.
Mm.
And also, of course, they can look at them in their own homes now.
So it's about preserving history, but it's also about sharing it then, if more people can see it.
There's not much point in preserving it if it's not going to be used.
Mm. When you come out of the archives and you're sort of in the library in general, where all the books and artifacts and articles and everything else is, what kind of people were coming through the library when you were the head of the library?
Well, there used to be quite a lot of authors writing books or articles, and also newspaper. There was a new West Australian roundsman who used to come every week, and that ceased quite early.
Sure.
But I used to look for some sort of story about something new that had come in, or something someone had found.
And did they ask? You would be the person that'd have to come and ask them, wouldn't they?
Well, whoever was on duty, yes.
We've done some research and we were speaking with somebody who is a librarian now. They've described the late 50s to the 70s as a golden time for library. How does that make you feel?
Well, I think it's true because we were trying to collect as much as we possibly could, and we were realising the divisions that we should be making in different sorts of material. I think that's a good statement.
People from all walks of life use the library, don't they?
They do, yes.
When you see school children come through, though, after having such a harrowing experience with them, do you kind of steer clear from those ones? No one would blame you. That's okay.
No, I think for kids to be using libraries is very important, and I think it's always very satisfying, especially if they're using the Batty library materials.
Absolutely. In 1974, you initiated the Oral History Program. For the first time, staff were to work solely on recording the living history of Western Australia. Do you want to tell us a bit about why you introduced that? What was your thought behind it?
Well, I think we'd always had that in mind that we would do it. Somebody gave us a recorder. It was Molly's idea that we should have oral history, and I think she must have organised for someone to give us that recorder. That was a very small amount of oral history we did. But then I think in the government's election manifesto, they said something or other about collecting the memories of people while they were living or something like that. And that was a very good stimulus to get a bit more money to do oral history.
Sure.
So that's when it took off.
Were you contacting people to tell their stories, or were people coming to you offering their stories?
A bit of both. The person to run the oral history program was a bit hard to decide what sort of person we needed.
And what did you arrive
on? We thought that perhaps a reporter, and that didn't work very well. Then we got a nurse, thinking that that person would be very sympathetic and what have you. A historian, and that wasn't so good. Anyway, we did get someone in the end who was very good, and she started an oral history association and got interest all over the place, and that was taken up throughout Australia.
So. A bit of trial and error to start, but we got there in the end. It's so important to have oral history. There are people who can't read or don't have access to written down material. Are you excited to see that that's something that's continuing still?
Well, I think it's very useful, but it's pretty unreliable too, because people's memories are not always terribly good. They do tend to exaggerate situations a bit. And it's not absolutely reliable. And history up till then had been based on written sources. But if you've got oral reports as well, they add another dimension, and they also add a warmth about a situation.
It must have been an interesting time because, like you said, up until then, history was strictly what was written down. Were people accepting, or were they excited by the idea of having recorded oral history in addition to that?
You mean researchers?
Well, just the public or anybody who was going to listen to these recorded histories, that must have been exciting to have that in addition to the textbooks.
I think that the public who used them were very pleased to have them, and I think it was certainly worthwhile. And it did, some of the public libraries were, and historical societies in the country areas were doing histories, doing oral histories, and giving us copies of them. So we had another source of not only our own interviewers.
You've done so many different things in your career, Margaret. Is there one particular one that stands out as a highlight, as the thing you're most proud of?
I don't think I'm proud of anything I've done. I've done a lot, but things change so much, and you start off something that you think is a marvellous idea and very good, and then the next lot of people come in and everyone wants to make their own mark on something. I think most of the things that I've started have been changed along the line. I mean, I think that just happens. I don't think I'm very proud of anything I've done. I've been pleased I've done it, but I think I'm probably more proud of a hole-in-one at golf or something like that.
So you're very humble then.
No one can change that.
One of the other things that I want to just come out of the library and out of the archive for a moment and talk about the Zonta Club. So you're part of one of the first ever chapters of the Zonta Club. Can you explain to us what that is?
Yes, it's an organisation of women, and it started in the United States after the First World War, when women had been doing jobs while men were away at the war. And after the war, they felt that they had a great deal to give still to the community. And so the Zonta Club was formed. And its main aims are to help women in the social field, and mainly in education and health. And they made a lot of clubs in the States, but then it became an international organisation and clubs were formed throughout the world. And they work very much with the United Nations bodies. And the thinking is that if they can help a woman to better her life, it's going to help the whole family. And so things such as small grants for a sewing machine or some seeds or something like that is going to bring more hope for a family. So the Zonta Club here has been doing a lot of good work and throughout all these years, and there are clubs all over Australia.
Lots of the women that we've spoken to who are in the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame, a lot of them are part of Zonta Club as well. What drew you to the Zonta Club?
I was invited to join because they wanted to have one person from each profession or calling. So there was an organiser who was a Canadian woman who was being sent to Australia to form clubs here, and she wrote to a number of people. I don't know how she got a selection of people, but I suppose because of archives I was asked to join. So she came out here and we all met and decided we would want to do that and formed the club.
Mm-hmm. Is there any Zonta material in the archive, in the State Archive?
No.
You didn't sneak any in there?
I don't think. Oh, yes, there is a lot now, yes.
Oh, that's good.
Mm. It's all the early records are in there.
It's so important that we keep all of these little bits and pieces in our history in the archive. Is there anything that you think isn't in the archive that should be, or if there's things in there that shouldn't be in there?
I don't think that I can think of anything. We, at one stage, were looking at areas where there wasn't anything and we thought we should. We thought that we would have a drive on certain areas. I think, as far as that was concerned, we had a drive on cattle station, cattle and sheep stations in the north of Western Australia. We brought in a lot of records. And I know that at one stage I decided I would visit all the government departments and talk to them about records, but there had been much more work done on that and far more systems, and so that all the government departments under, I wouldn't say under control.
They've got better protocols in place now.
Yes.
It must be a relief to see so many people being better at record keeping now than
yes.
I imagine it was a bit like the Wild West before.
Oh, yes, there are all sorts of excellent systems now.
You retired in 1989, Margaret. Did you take up golf then, or was that something you were always doing?
No, I'd played that always. Well, I've been a member of the Royal Western Australian Historical Society for a long time. I became the president in the year I retired, in 1989. So I've been involved with them ever since, and still am.
I find it so funny, of all the women we've spoken to, you all tell me that you retire, but then you end up actually doing more work afterwards. So have you finally started to slow down now?
Oh, yes. I'm not doing very much now.
Okay, good. I think you've earned a break. Looking after everyone else's history. In 1999, you were also awarded an OAM. What was that like?
Oh, well, that was a great honour and surprise. I was very pleased about that, but that didn't really change anything.
Still put your pants on one leg at a time like the rest of us. The other one, of course, and we have to talk about this, it's the reason that we're here, part of this podcast, is the WA Women's Hall of Fame. You were inducted in 2014, just a few years after the hall had actually started. What was it like when you received that email or that phone call saying we'd like to induct you?
I was absolutely startled and amazed and very honoured.
Why is it important that we celebrate and we recognise the success of women? Because I know you might say that you're not particularly proud of any one or two moments, but you have achieved a lot, and it's quite important the role that you held, Margaret.
I think it's very good to give women some acclaim, because I think they do such an amazing dual sort of job in the nurturing side of them and also the outside work that they do, the voluntary work that they do, or not voluntary always, but I think they do an amazing job in that dual role that they play.
So what's that saying about women's work is never done?
No, they just accept it, that they are there to help people and help their families, and the role of housekeeping is something that's just
all
there.
Last question, Margaret, and there's a few people we've interviewed who have things named after them. You actually have an award named after you. Do you want to tell us what that award is?
Yes, that's for excellence in research. And I think that's very important, because it's so obvious all the time that things are not factual, that are published and spoken, and people say, oh, I read that in the paper, or I googled that, and now all that misinformation is being repeated and repeated. Doing original research is extremely important to get the facts right.
You must be banging your head against the wall. The last few years we've been watching misinformation spread across the world with COVID-19. You must be banging your head against the wall saying, if we just use the archives and if people just kept better records and they weren't spreading the wrong records, this wouldn't be a problem.
Yes, I agree. But people are lazy and they can't be bothered taking the trouble to go to original sources.
Mm.
And they find a reference somewhere and, oh, that's right, that's good.
Hey, Margaret, how much music is in the state archive? Do you archive or do we keep records of music?
No, there is a music library in the state library.
Okay.
There is a little bit of music. One of the governors made up a song called Western Australia for Me. That was something that I think is there.
Do you know which governor that was or what year
Robinson.
That was? Robinson. What year was that in? Do you remember?
Oh, no. Probably the 50s, 1850s, maybe.
I'm definitely going to have to look for that one. Margaret, final question. I promise it's the final one now. We're a part of a radio station, so we play lots of music on the radio. What's your favourite sort of music? Or do you have a favourite song or a favourite musician?
No, I don't. I'm old-fashioned in music, and I like classical music, but I like gentle music.
Margaret, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being so generous and letting us come to your home and
well,
ask you lots of questions.
Well, I don't know how much good all that was.
That was perfect.
Thanks to Margaret Medcalf and to all the women at the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the lovely women who make this podcast possible. Our executive producer and editor is Janae Gibson. Courtney Withers, Fiona Bartholomaeus and Sophie Minisale are the assistant producers. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll catch you next week for our final episode, episode 12.